It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Today is Friday. Casual Friday, May 4th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday. You know what that means. Cliff Schechter will be with us. Also, Isabel Gillies will be providing us with movie selections for our weekend. Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street will be here to tell us about the police reform organization project. Also on the program today, job numbers out. Not good. Americans elect sort of stalled. Mitt Romney meets with a huge racist. The Al-Qaeda document dump, fracking. No squirt guns at the RNC, but you can carry a real gun at the Republican National Convention. Last night, before we get to Cliff, last night I went on Free Talk Live, which is a radio program syndicated nationally with some guys up in New Hampshire, and I was on for an hour, and we will attach that or create an actual entire bonus podcast for members. We'll talk a little bit about it, but it was rather stunning. And what was really shocking too was really more the ads that I sat through. A lot of Bitcoin, a lot of gold, a lot of Join the Shire Society. And, we'll talk about that later in the program as to what exactly the Shire Society is. I can't tell if it's actually just New Hampshire or New Hampshire, as some might say, or actually that the society, you know, to actually head to, like, where the Hobbit lives. The guys were very polite and far more enjoyable to talk to than your run-of-the-mill libertarians. They don't consider themselves libertarians. They consider themselves voluntarists. But we will talk about that more in the program. Before we get there, we have to go somewhere else. This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature. And, of course, featuring literally hundreds of audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. As a listener of the Majority Report, you can get a free Audible download book at audiblepodcast.com/majority report. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. We'll put that link at majority.fm. You can go there, pick up Noam Chomsky's Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. It's free, folks. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Now, before we get to Cliff Schechter, we need to play Cliff Schechter's theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. If you want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter.
Yes, Jimmy Reefer Cake has left us, but his musical stylings remain, and the only proper way to introduce Cliff Schechter. Cliff, hello.
Why, hello there, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. It's Friday. I'm feeling casual, and I don't know where to start here. The jobs numbers are bad. They're not good, and they're bad. And the unemployment rate has dropped from, I think it was 8.2% to 8.1%. But that's mostly a function. Non-farm payroll rose by 115,000 people in April, and March was revised upwards. But the real important thing to note here is that we had almost 340,000 people leave the job force, and so they are no longer counted. And my guess is those people didn't want to leave the job force. They simply have run out of their unemployment benefits, and so they're no longer counted as really being unemployed.
It's an awesome system, isn't it?
It's fantastic. You know, it's really sort of like it really is the opposite of the rich get richer.
Yes, that's a good point.
But it happens parallel to it, because the rich have gotten richer. We see it in terms of productivity gains going to the wealthiest. There was a report that was out that CEO compensation has increased 700, and these figures are stunning. 725% from 1978 to 2011, CEO compensation has increased.
But actual regular workers' wages have gone up 5%, so that's pretty close to 725.
If you take out the first 720% of it, it is almost identical.
Right, it's the same, and it's amazing. And if you listen to Mitt Romney's old business buddy Edward Conard, who I don't know if you've talked about on this show or not.
I have that story. It's
his new book. He's awesome, because if only it had gone up 825% and not 725%, then all those slacker, lazy people who he calls art history majors would be working harder and deciding that it was worth it to get out there and get jobs and make money. And I assume then that unemployment would go to -4%. And also we'd all permanently be stoned and in a state of bliss.
Exactly. That's the recipe for success. We just got to get there. We just got to get these rich people just a little bit richer.
That's right. Now, there's not enough of a motivation now, is what this guy says in his book.
Of course.
And he's like Romney's good buddy. So it just, there's just a little insight into how awesomely these guys think.
It is stunning. And, you know, there's a couple of things that are a couple of stories that are floating around here that I want to talk about, and I know that they coalesce in some fashion, and I'm not quite sure how exactly they do. But
we will make them coalesce.
There's a couple of things that we know. I had a conversation with someone last night who was saying to me, you know, I can't understand why the Democrats and President Obama doesn't see that there is such political hay to be reaped by becoming more populist at this time. And,
yes.
And you know, combining a conversation I had with Eric Alterman yesterday and a piece that I just saw on Hullabaloo by David Atkins. Comparing and contrasting FDR to President Obama. Now, we know at this time that, at the very least, rhetorically, austerity won out for much of Obama's presidency, and won out because he was also promoting it. We also know that even Nancy Pelosi has succumbed to this by saying that she would support Simpson-Bowles, even if it's a cynical political ploy.
Right, which obviously is a huge problem.
It's a huge problem because we also know that the job...
Danny Hoyer literally has like a fork and a knife out and is ready to eat Social Security at this point.
Exactly.
So if we don't have Nancy Pelosi sitting there and ensuring that this doesn't happen, I don't know what we've got.
And we have seen the implications of austerity already because we know that over 600,000 jobs that have been lost in the past 3 years were government jobs. I don't know, 150,000 of those education jobs and so on. And this is the big drag on our economy. This is the big drag on our
job. Mitt Romney told me that government jobs aren't real jobs. They don't count. So I guess we shouldn't count those. Those don't really matter.
Well, yes, but we also, you know, it wasn't just Mitt Romney telling you that. You know, he may not have said it as explicitly.
Entire Republican Party.
Well, it's not just the. I mean, we got President Obama coming up and saying, you know, government's got to tighten their belt just like a family does, which of course is 100% wrong. But
that's like the opposite of actually. But yeah,
and. You know, yesterday when I was talking to Eric Alterman, he made somewhat of this point, but I want to read this piece or just a segment of this piece from David Atkins at Hullabaloo. And he's contrasting, comparing Obama to FDR and answering the question, why doesn't the president, like FDR did, simply welcome their hatred? This is, you know, this is coming out from that story that's in the New York Times this Sunday in the magazine
about all the business guys sitting around the table.
Right. Of all the wealthy guys, how much they hate Obama. Now, my speculation is that the Obama administration made sure that this story got in there because, you know.
My speculation is Joe Biden actually carried the story by hand over to them.
Yes.
He actually might have tattooed it on his chest and brought it so to make sure they could see it and print it up.
Right. Or maybe
I'm just speculating here. Obviously.
Right. Yeah. There's no way to know. Maybe he shaved it out of his chest. I don't know why we're going in that direction with this story.
I don't either.
Okay. So David Atkins says it's a function of two simple factors, money and votes. And then he says FDR didn't need the banker's money. Campaign wasn't nearly as expensive in those days. And he says, FDR also had the votes of the racist South. And Eric Alterman made this point on the program yesterday, that Roosevelt specifically refused to support a liberal congressman's attempt to pass a federal anti-lynching legislation. This, incidentally, comes from schmoop.com. Southern senators filibustered. And FDR defied black leaders and his own wife because, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt was adamant about supporting rights for African Americans by refusing to throw his support behind the measure. And this is a quote from FDR. "I did not choose the tools with which I must work," he explained. Had I been permitted to choose them, I would have selected quite different ones. But I've got to get legislation passed by Congress to save America. The Southerners occupy strategic places on most of the Senate and House committees. If I come out for the anti-lynching bill now, they will block every bill I ask Congress to pass to keep America from collapsing. I just can't take that risk. And it goes on to talk about Roosevelt's need to accommodate Southern racists. And then, you know, we know the rest of the story. Once the Democrats basically provided the impetus for racial emancipation and for gender emancipation in the late 60s, they lost a huge amount of their electoral force.
Right.
And the Democrats then also were at a huge money disadvantage because those corporatists who had been wanting to get back at the Democrats for those 40 years had them not just the means in terms of the money, but they could turn that into an electoral force. And so we're stuck in this situation here. And I think the real, you know, the point is at this juncture is that our politics don't work anymore. They simply have been destroyed by the mass of money that now controls our politics.
And that is definitely, obviously, very, very true. I mean, our politics are corrupted in such a huge, in such a huge way. Obviously, it's been that way for a while. The rise of, and David Atkins talks about this, the rise of mass communications, the effectiveness, because television lends itself so much to emotion. And these guys, of course, use emotion over logic. They use anecdotes. They take things out of context. They show you Willie Horton ads and, you know, all the sorts of things that you can do with TV that you couldn't really do as much and reach as many people before. Campaigns have made campaigns hugely more expensive. And we've chosen to do that, by the way, because the airwaves are public. The government owns them, and they could be forced to carry free advertisements or at least give free time to candidates to mitigate the effect of the 30-second ad. And then purposely people have chosen not to do that. So yes, that is all true, and that's important to note. But I gotta disagree, and I have a lot of respect for David. But I've seen he's written things like this before, and I've disagreed with him before. I don't think that analysis is fully on, and I'll tell you why. There's a whole lot of reasons why, and again, I do respect him, and I think he's got a good knowledge of history. But first of all, there's no doubt that the conservative rise since the 1970s, I mean, we've talked about this before, it was not a coincidence that the Heritage Foundation and ALEC were created the same year in 1973, and that Paul Weyrich was behind this, and Coors and these guys. But it's also important to note that this, it's not like this stuff didn't exist in the 20s and 30s. Okay, you had J. Howard Pugh, eventually Sun Oil, Sunoco, it became. You had Gannett with massive access to the media. You had the DuPont company, which was a huge opponent of FDR's, and who had a regular radio show. You obviously had there was a Christian radio broadcast and all sorts of other ones that called FDR a communist. I mean, the same language you hear today by these idiots today. I mean, it's so familiar to me because, my background was I never wrote my dissertation, but I almost got my PhD in history, and I studied the rise of conservatism. And I can tell you there's nothing that was there in the 1970s and 80s that wasn't there in the 30s. From the religious right to the corporate right, J. Howard Pugh by himself, who was worth gazillions, put money into the National Association of Manufacturers, to the American Liberty League, all these groups that went after FDR. And the American Liberty League, according to congressional testimony by a former military man, Smedley Butler, was perhaps involved with the beginning plans for a coup to overthrow FDR, which I'm not – if you know that whole story, Sam. I mean, they were – these guys were getting together, and there was something called the business plot. Smedley Butler was asked to march, kind of like the bonus army that marched from Washington because they didn't get their benefits. They were asking this military guy to march the military units of angry and impoverished veterans to D.C. so they could have a smooth transition and get FDR out of power. And the DuPonts were supposedly in on this, and a number of people. And much like with the Select Committee on Assassination of the Church Committee with Martin Luther King and JFK, they never seemed to follow up on these things. They came to the conclusion that there likely was a plot there. Well, the same thing here. They came to the conclusion, the committees that looked at this, that there was evidence that a plot existed, but there were no charges ever filed. They never fully followed up on it. Point being that FDR wasn't, in David's piece, it almost seems like he was saying FDR wasn't risking as much. He was risking potentially being thrown out in a coup, is what he was risking. And he was also angering very many very wealthy families with nefarious connections. So what I'm trying to say is, yes, there wasn't the money couldn't do as much damage in some ways, you know, as that can today, certainly because of the existence of mass communications and campaigning's gotten so much more expensive. But FDR could have been thrown out of government. FDR could have still had many groups out to smear him and destroy him, you know, with the usual kinds of leaflets and attacks and people giving barnstorming speeches across the country and the rest, and he stood up to it. All right, and I don't think that, you know, I just can't agree with the premise that even if things have gotten as bad as they've gotten, and even if money is as bad as it is, that nobody has the power to stand up to it. Because if we didn't, then Democrats would never, you know, people in Midwestern states like where I am, Sherrod Brown and Tom Harkin and people like that, Byron Dorgan in North Dakota, they would never win if it just came down to moneyed interest, because they would always want these guys to lose. Barack Obama wouldn't win in 2008. I know Wall Street gave him a lot of money. I'm not claiming he didn't raise money from these guys, but at the same time, if the oil guys and most of the big money wanted to win in the end won, it wouldn't be Barack Obama. Okay, and it wouldn't be all sorts of Democrats, and you wouldn't have polls showing that the vast majority of people believe in the minimum wage should be higher and believe that taxes should be higher than the top 1%, because how much money have these guys spent on trying to convince all of us that it should be otherwise?
All right.
So they're beatable.
Well, okay. I think I'm gonna end up joining you. I'm gonna end up joining you there, but I'm gonna take a different tact here, because I think really the issue is not so much that the economic forces are fundamentally different. I think the argument that Atkins and I think Alterman would make would be that the difference is the racial divide, that. Those people who would have responded to that message, or a big chunk of those people who would have responded to that populist message, are now alienated from the potential messengers because of race. And now I think that's a valid point, but I don't know that it really carries through. I think that was a valid point for 30 years.
Yes.
I think that clearly we see that cleave between labor and the social emancipation wings of the Democratic Party or the left in the late 60s was real. But, you know, to me, the biggest proof. And I think, you know, this is why I think there was so many people who sort of bought into this notion that President Obama was going to bring about this change, because
right. The
idea that implicit or explicit in the election of President Obama was that he had overcome that deficit, that he had overcome it, or that time had essentially overcome it, that we now were out of the specter of the wake of the implications of the Civil Rights Act, that those hardcore racists who were going to still sort of dictate that the notion of blacks being emancipated and getting full rights, at least institutionally in this country, that most of those people had died. Had just given up the ghost, essentially.
Now, can I make a counterpoint quickly? Because I think it's important, and their analysis on the racial element is exactly right. There's no doubt that the South has always been a one-party state, really not a very democratic state, many parts of the South, so that they were in the bag for Democrats as long as FDR didn't touch race, and now they're pretty much in the bag for the Republicans. But there's some other important things that have changed, too. The map, in a manner of speaking, has flipped so that, you know, you and I are old enough, sadly, to remember, you know, when Bill Clinton, I remember being – and then during the 92 election, there was a big question of whether Clinton could beat George H.W. Bush, because the Republicans had this electoral lock. The Democrat, they had the solid South, and they also were, you know, they had, this will be funny to talk about this now, but they had California, because remember, Reagan and Bush had won California in 88, and Reagan had won it twice and was a California guy, and Nixon was a California guy, and so they had put this in, but so in the medium term, or short term, if you want to call it that, the Civil Rights Act and those and what occurred with the Democrats standing up for it, LBJ was right. The Democrats lost the South, as he predicted they would, and the Republicans were still holding, you know, more moderate, if you want to call them, states, because they hadn't offended them by going completely nuts yet on issues like race and religion and other things. So they still had California, and they still had, you know, a number of northeastern states. You got to remember, this is back in a time when New Hampshire was a solid Republican state. Maine was often, you know, back at the saying in 1944, I think, with FDR, with Alf Landon, or is it 40? I'm getting mixed up now. But, you know, as goes Maine, so goes Vermont, because those are the only two states that FDR actually lost. Mm-hmm. Well, those are now Democratic states. That, yes, that rural whites in the South have gone very much Republican, but there's many states in the North, East, and in the mid, in the northern Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota, places that don't have huge urban centers and are still very, have become, going in the opposite direction, have become very Democratic states that FDR did not have the benefit of. I mean, now, you know, you have to remember, you know, for Obama to lose California or New York right now would be quite a feat.
It would be it'd be impossible.
Which is back then, California was basically a Republican state, and New York was a swing state. I mean, right. it went in different directions. So yes, okay, the South is gone, but right now the question is almost the opposite. I mean, Democrats are heading towards an electoral lock, because I'll tell you right now, because of younger voters being so Democratic, because of the influx of Hispanic voters and Northeastern, you want to call them, I just wrote a column on this, snowbirds who are headed, you know, who are retiring to places like you know, Nevada and Arizona and New Mexico, and retiring to Florida and Virginia and North Carolina. These are places where the electoral votes have grown, but these are all headed in a Democratic direction.
That's
you
right.
Know, I mean, and if you want me to really blow your effing mind, you wait till 2016, when Texas is a lean Republican swing state, and 2020 when it's a legitimate swing state, because of the growing younger, you know, vote, Hispanic vote, people, Northerners who are retiring there. South Carolina is heading in the same direction. So you've now got a divide in the South, even, of the states where that are growing and are becoming states that are heading towards being more center left states. North Carolina and Virginia are already well there. So is Florida. Obviously, wait till Texas and South Carolina, which are going through similar things, and Georgia, get there. And you're soon going to be in a place where I can't think of a state bigger than 11 electoral votes where the Republicans could call a lock.
All right. Well, okay. Now, here's.
These are all important trends. If we're going to look at, you know, I'll let you go here. I'm just going to say these are all very important trends.
I agree totally. And I don't even think you need to make that argument on a presidential level, because the other way that you can make that argument is simply that President Obama won.
Pretty convincingly in places like Indiana and North Carolina and an electoral vote in Nebraska. It was a pretty wide coalition.
And I think that on some level, and, you know, maybe this is maybe I'm just projecting here, but I think on some level, even that, 40-year-old guy in Indiana, white guy, blue collar white guy, who, had he been 40 years older, you know, and so was around 40 years ago, who would have rejected the Democratic Party because maybe they were too concerned about black people. I think that there was almost a reverse projection onto President Obama, which was, okay, I'm gonna vote for this guy who maybe my antecedent would have perceived as denying me some money and giving it to minorities. But I'm going to vote for this guy because it is an expression that dynamic is over, and now it's time for him to take this power away from the money and give it back to guys like me.
And maybe this sentiment has lingered or even gotten worse in certain places that have been left behind where this kind of growth hasn't happened. You know, maybe in parts of Mississippi and Alabama and whatever. But
it doesn't matter. States, it doesn't matter on a presidential level. But here's the other
okay.
Issue. Is that so I think, you know, that's where the expectation that President Obama would have done more, because politically speaking, it seemed that he had overcome at least one, or in fact, both of those aspects, which supposedly, you know, would have been present for a generic Democrat to overcome. One, he had overcome the money issue because he was able to raise so much money in small donations and whatever he was able to raise it, period. And two,
which is actually another very, I'll let you continue, but a very huge counterpoint to this, which is they put together a 13 million person email list and did the kind of small money fundraising
heretofore. And the other counterpoint,
and then they chose not to go with it.
Right. And the other counterpoint is that they actually were able to win electorally, not having the uphill climb of the sort of implied notion that, well, Democrats are just the party of blacks, but they actually voted for an African American. And so now the only part, and so I think, you know, we're in agreement on that. The only part where it breaks down is that we still were looking at, although Democrats at that time, you know, had a very brief majority in the Senate and then lost it, but they had a majority in the House. They were still looking at a Senate that was still much more influenced by that dynamic than maybe on a presidential level. You still, I mean, because if the presidential election had been reflected in the Senate and the House, the majorities would have been even larger. But
that's true. But I would make the argument again that a lot of what has occurred was the initial failures of the Obama administration. Okay.
Well, the bottom line is that's the thing is they didn't take advantage of that. They didn't take advantage of the fact that they had won on both those.
They win Pennsylvania. They win Indiana. They win an electoral vote in Ben Nelson's Nebraska. And if they come in, you know, and they use that, and they use their huge approval ratings, and we've talked about this before, to go and travel to all the states I just mentioned, not to mention Florida, where there's Republican Mel Martinez and others, and make sure that they made it clear at that point that he was more popular than they were, the bigger stimulus, which Krugman and Stiglitz and everyone else who knows much more about economics than me can make that statement too. A health care bill that had a public option and kicked in sooner. If it couldn't get a public option, fine, but at least were some of these benefits kicked in sooner and some of the other things. Well, then some of those guys who are not overly affected by the racial element, this is where I would go to an analysis. Have you ever had Tom Schaller on your show?
It's been a while, but I know.
Wrote a great book, Whistling Past Dixie, and his whole point was that in certain southern states, a place like Mississippi maybe, the racial compellment, you know, element was so dominant that even doing economic populism couldn't overcome it. But in rural parts of, let's say, Wisconsin, well, that's not even important because Obama's going to probably win Wisconsin, but let's say certain swing states, rural parts of Ohio, rural parts of Indiana, rural parts of Missouri, Missouri's a little more southern, but you know what I'm getting at here,
right,
which is other states where race has not always been such a headlight, a forefront, in-your-face issue, I do think he wins those voters back with economic populism. And I do think, you know, and then I think that in the growing states like North Carolina, Virginia, the growing, you know, high, you know, growing sort of educated workforce there overcomes those voters. So this becomes a liability. His loss of the racist South at this point is a liability in very few states. You can take a half dozen, you know, you could take Alabama, Mississippi, a few of the border states, Oklahoma, places like that, all of which are not very electoral rich, and he doesn't need them, frankly.
Right.
And you don't need on the Senate level, I'm sorry, but he could have gotten a lot more done had he been more forceful, and had he been more forceful, and the unemployment level at this point is under 7%, and things are headed at a much faster pace. I promise you, a lot of those voters where race is not the first thing that pops to their mind, outside of a couple certain states we've talked about, are in his coalition. And I think everything I've looked at tells me that. And big money can do what big money's going to do. But he would have enough money from small donors and from other large donors who aren't of the far right financial ilk that he would be fine.
And I think the conclusion, you know, one can come to is that either he is – it doesn't really matter whether in his heart he is a neoliberal on economics or whether or not that's just, you know – he's judged by his actions. But I think it also is indicative of the fact that this straight electoral calculation is, and, you know, I was trying to get to this. I spoke to Russ Feingold this week on the program, too, and I was trying to get to this with him, and I didn't really have the time to bring it out as much as I had wanted to. But that the problem is not just money in our politics from an electoral sense. The problem is that we have such a high level of income inequality. We have such a high amount of concentration of money in so few hands at the high end of the spectrum that it's distorting the legislative process, and that it's, you know, it's quite clear that President Obama can get elected. He doesn't need, all of the Wall Street money to get elected. He doesn't need it. He just yep. doesn't need it. He's not going to need it this time. He's not going to get it, and he's still going to win. The problem is that the wealthy in this country have bought I just don't think that the problem is so much the electoral process as much as it is the legislative process that they have bought. Because
especially on the lower, we talked about this last time, I think, the state legislative elections, which are very easily corruptible in state courts and things like that. And then, as you said, even congressional seats, in some places, Senate seats. And there's no doubt that in those races, the money can be a lot more dangerous.
But I'm not even saying I'm saying that the corruption is also in that the lobbying and the revolving door that exists. That's that I think that part of the process, the notion that the policy prescriptions are so narrowed down to like either, hey, should we go with Rubin's ideas or this Rubinite's ideas? The policy responses for this are so narrow, and the conversation has become so narrowed. That's, I think, where the problem is. I mean, that's why we see Nancy Pelosi going out and sort of like signing on to Simpson polls. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, that's the problem, is that it becomes something of perception, which is we have to look like the reasonable people. And actually,
to whom?
No, you don't.
To
that's
whom?
What I mean. To whom? To David Brooks? No, you don't need to. You need to stand up for a program that every single damn poll in Social Security tells you has an 80% plus popularity rate. You need to stand up and educate people, which we once believed in, that you could actually do, and tell them that if you just get rid of the $110,000 cap right now on Social Security so that Mitt Romney's paying 0.5% of his income on it, if you were to either get rid of that or raise the hell out of it, the Social Security problem, which doesn't have a problem for the next 20 years, would have a problem never.
See,
I think it's so frustrating.
I think that dynamic, I think that notion that
it reminds
people
me of the public option. I don't want to cut you off. I just want to say it's such an easy sale, and that's why it's frustrating. Go ahead, Sam.
See, this is the point, though, is that I think the idea that San Francisco Nancy Pelosi is coming out in support of a plan, regardless of whether or not I think it's just sort of tactical or strategic or whatever, is coming out in favor of a plan that cuts a program that is beloved by 80% of the American people. The only answer as to why that happens is that there is something fundamentally wrong with our politics, that they're not even electoral anymore. That you don't even.
I can't agree with you more when it comes to that.
The conversation doesn't even involve. It's like we can.
The conversation in D.C. doesn't really reflect what anybody out here actually believes.
And more than that, I think the idea is that I can support something that 80% of the population disagrees with. I mean, God knows what the numbers are in her district in San Francisco. Right? I mean, we're talking national.
Probably 102%
exactly.
of Social Security.
And
there.
She can come out and do that because it's almost as if, like, the ocean of money that they or the small lake of money, because it's so narrow, it's just extremely deep lake that they swim in.
Loch Ness-like.
Has fundamentally distorted the checks and balances of and the accountability of our politicians, because there's just so much money that will.
Well, I think there's absolutely no doubt about that. I mean, that's another fight that has to be had obviously.
I think it's the only fight. I mean, frankly, I think it's the only fight. I mean, that's why, you know, this week we had 30,000 people, 20,000 people. I'm not sure how many in the streets of New York and people around the country protesting. You know, that's the only encouraging thing I see on the horizon, because I don't even think that the, you know, Citizens United, horrible, yes, tons of money coming into our politics, but you're still not seeing, even though they're faced with this onslaught of money, you're still not seeing them go the easier route, supposedly, from an a purely electoral strategy. And I don't know, it's... Try not to get depressed.
Well, it's disconcerting, because when you see Nancy Pelosi, it's like I expect it from Steny Hoyer, the way I expected it from Ben Nelson and Evan Bayh and these guys. But when you see it from her, it sort of tells you how pervasive this is. And it's like, I don't even know that it's actual financial corruption. I'm going to give Nancy Pelosi the benefit of the doubt and say that I think she's been great on a lot of stuff, or she has been in the past. I think it's just, you're right, it's this sort of this privileged mindset. You don't even worry about being reelected anymore.
It's the corruption. I don't think it's Nancy Pelosi being financially corrupted, because I just that doesn't make any sense. I mean, she's perfectly wealthy. She's in a safe district. I think it's that she has to come out and do this because of the horribly corrupt miasma that she lives in, essentially.
Right. Well, and this is the mindset. This is sort of become the culture of course there's something wrong with Social Security. Of course it needs to be reformed. You know, this is when you see the idiots like Robert Samuelson, who writes for the Post, writing this dribble that he calls it a welfare program, and then he gets all his facts wrong about it and tries to say that it's not its own dedicated pool of money. It's mixed with the general fund. All the other garbage these guys say, either they're obviously lying or they don't even know what the hell they're talking about. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, of course. And it becomes the mindset. So you think, well, yeah, Simpson Bowles, that's the responsible thing to do. We should do that. And that's what all your wealthy friends are saying, whatever. And even if you're not corrupt, you just kind of think that's what you have to do. And you're right, breaking through that. Because, again, if that didn't exist, would we have been in Iraq for the last however many years? Would we be in Afghanistan right now? Would we not have passed the Buffett rule? And you can go on and on, because all these things have 70%. Support from the population. So obviously they're not reflecting, and a lot of these Republican senators, there's not like all of them come from the vastly right-wing states. A lot of them do, but there's certainly a good 10 or 15 of them that come from either blue states like Maine or Massachusetts, or come from swing states. You know what I mean? And they're not representing what most people believe either. So obviously they feel immune to this crap too. Or they're, more scared of the attack from the Tea Party right. It's, you know what I mean?
Well, all I know is that the lame duck session is going to be the most interesting time of the year, and perhaps the most devastating. It's probably I imagine there must be, and I haven't done this calculus, a difference between a President Obama during that lame duck session and a President Romney a lame duck President Obama or a non-lame duck President Obama probably changes that calculation, but I guess we'll see. And I'm not sure which one is a better outcome, frankly. But Cliff, sadly, it is time to say adieu until next week. And
nice French there, my man. Did you learn that from Mitt?
Yeah, indeed. C'est vrai. Bien sûr. Ouais.
You parle très bien le français.
Well, I wanted to talk about that, how the sort of the Republican side of it, when they becoming so sort of marginalized in their sort of virulent attacks on women. But, there's always next Friday.
Well, one thing I think I can predict is they will keep attacking women's rights between now and next Friday. In fact, they may even find a new way to do it beyond just trying to stop them from earning equal pay and from not being attacked. So maybe there's a way, something we haven't thought of.
Right. Well, I guess we'll have to see.
And they'll find it. If it's out there, I really want to, there's that Arizona, the birth is menstruation. So, I mean, if they can get there in Arizona, you know, I mean, maybe next they'll pass the bill where, you know, that birth is when you have that gleam in your eye. Or maybe that first Milwaukee's best at the frat party, you know? These guys are so awesome, we don't know where they'll take it. So, you know?
I'm just waiting until they get back to that thing where your wife is chattel. That's what I'm looking forward to, because I want to get something out of this, frankly.
You should. Well, if you look at the timeline, we're only about 6 months from that.
Right.
So
beautiful. Well,
get ready. Get excited.
Cliff Schechter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Sam. Have a great week, buddy.
You too. Okay, folks, in a moment we're going to go to Isabel Gillies. But I just wanted to mention briefly, and I think we'll have Jay from the Best of the Left on the program sometime next week. But the Best of the Left and the David Pakman Show and the Young Turks are starting an organization that is basically a progressive media funding platform. And you can find out more about this. Go to majority.fm, and we have a link there. Or you can go to Indiegogo.com, Our Blue Media. We'll have that link on majority.fm. They're looking for donations to build this platform. To be honest, I haven't had a chance to look into this to see if that we're going to be a part of it. I think so, but I got to get the details. But I can tell you that I have a tremendous amount of trust in Jay and David and the Young Turks. And so I suspect what they're building is going to be something that you're going to like, and it's going to be helpful for all progressive media. And at a time where we can watch our corporate media, regardless of how they brand themselves, and see zero coverage of Occupy Wall Street, at a time where, you know, they will do all these stories about why government's not responsive and this and that, but ignore the one movement that is amassing people and trying to get this government accountability, government responsiveness. I think it gives you just a sense of the limitations of that media. I still watch some of the programs, but it's limited. And so check this out. It's at majority.fm. We're going to take a break. The link is anyways. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Isabel Gillies. And also stick around, because Jeff Smith is going to be here, and he's going to tell us about this. I basically saw him tweeting about it last night, this police reform organization project. Stunning talk by former policemen, New York City policemen, about what they engage in. And there's also a couple other stories I want to touch on with Jeff that have cropped up in the wake of the May Day protests by Occupy Wall Street. We'll be right back after this with Isabel Gillies.
Here it is, the Republicans' health care plan for America. Don't get sick.
If you think that's a fair ad, okay, then you're a Republican and an asshole. Have at it, Hoss. Be in that party. Despicable, man.
They're the bad guys.
Endless taxpayer bailout.
Yeah, that's not true.
When Obama won, the reason why we worked so hard for him, we didn't want a garden variety politician.
Taking a stand, not just cutting deals.
That's what vision is. Yeah. That's what vision is.
The Best of the Left podcast. The best of the truly liberal media. Edited, organized, and mixed. Only at bestoftheleft.com.
Oh,
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. And on the phone is Isabel Gillies. But before we go to her, of course, we need to play one of the four Isabel Gillies theme songs that we have.
Four.
Maybe we'll rotate these these through over the weeks.
Woo, woo.
But let's hear this one from Jimmy Reefer Cake.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Yes,
I
ladies and gentlemen,
so much.
The best-selling author found at IsabelGillies.com. And also the wife of that dude on that show.
That's right. But no more. But no more, Sam.
I know. When's that coming back?
It's not. He left. Goodbye.
Well, why can't you guys get a divorce and then you go and marry somebody else on the show?
I know, you'd think. But they're done. He's done. They didn't even... I'm sure I've told you, they didn't even call me, right? They just... That was it. I never heard from anyone ever again.
That's weird.
I know, 12 years.
That's really weird. They must not have liked you there.
Oh, God, it could have been true. Not a lot of people like me because they all wanted Chris and Mariska to get together. So I was like this annoying wife, like the pregnant, sort of grumpy.
But that's your character.
I know. But people.
What did you do?
Would
you get diva-ish on the set? Like, that doesn't.
No,
that's
maybe a lot of things, but diva is not one of them.
I've never thought of you that way, but maybe I've never seen that side of you.
No, it was the fans just loved them, and they didn't love me, so that they would say, you know, they would say terrible things about Kathy Stabler.
But that's, I understand why people might not have appreciated Kathy Stabler. Was that your name or your character, Kathy Stabler?
Yeah.
That is. You just don't strike me as a Kathy or Stabler.
Kathy Stabler. Sure.
Now, did you like? Sure. Were you sort of his rock? Did you, like, stabilize him?
Yeah,
did you ever pick up on that? Like, this, you're the stabler?
No, yeah. No, I didn't. That went right over my head for 12 years, Sam.
Wow.
Seriously, I never even thought about that. Stable. See, it's all about him. And I was
just sort of... None of this explains why nobody would have called you from, like, even, like...
A producer. Nobody.
Wow.
I read it on a blog. Actually, I didn't even read it. My husband in real life sent it to me, and he's like, I guess no more of that. Chris left.
Oh my gosh, that's horrible.
But move onward. You know, it's all right. 12 years, that's enough.
Of course. But you would think you'd get a muffin basket or something.
I know. Or, yeah, how about a T-shirt? How about some cool swag? How about some cool, you know, rain jacket
business.
Or something that says Law and Order?
Do you are you auditioning at all? Do you go out anymore? Do you care about that stuff? No.
Nope. No. I write all day long, and that's it.
Yeah. I mean, I hear that.
Yeah, that's all I do. And then the kids, and then, you know, I look forward to this, you know, like you have no idea.
I do have an idea. I know how much you look forward to it.
I do. I love it. So I'm conflicted about this week.
Hold on for a second.
All right.
Okay? We can't move right into the movie recommendations because there's still something left over from last week, and I'm not talking about this.
What
I'm talking. What?
Shocking. I'm sort of shocked. Is someone really saying that menstruation is birth?
Wait a second.
Is that really
can you hear the music playing?
No?
Oh, you can't hear it. I've got it on my computer, so you can't hear it. Right now, I'm playing the Chariots of Fire theme song.
Yeah,
God, I swear to God, I can't even play that because it just reminds me of working at that Five and Dime. But last I spoke to you, what?
Did you love it?
No, I didn't watch it.
Oh, Sam.
I couldn't. It just
really,
that was just not a good period in my life.
Oh, 1980.
Yeah,
you were 10.
No, I wasn't 10.
But believe me,
I was 27 years old. And I was in my first marriage. No, I'm not that old. Look, but no, there was a bad period for me. I was a fat kid. I was alienated from other people, people. And
may I tell you that I'm watching the brutality of boys in the fourth grade? It's no joke.
Oh, no.
I thought it was girls. I thought girls were the ones that were horrible and mean girls and all
those
things. No, boys are brutal. They're eye rollers. They separate out. They don't include you.
I got news for you. You're going through this with your fourth grader? I'm going through this. I went through this with my daughter when she was in kindergarten and in first grade. The eye rolling. You're not getting invited to my birthday party. You know, your birthday party's 7 months away. Why are you using that as a hammer now?
Oh, it's so brutal. It's just this. And it's all of a sudden. Suddenly, for some reason, you're not going to be my partner. You can't play in this. We think you're an idiot. I mean, but brutal.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm glad Milo's going through this early. Because I figure, you know,
if it continues?
Well, I mean,
No. It won't. It won't. That was a silly thing to say. Because you know why? She's getting tools and she's getting all sorts of systems in place to deal with it. Yes, she is.
No, we're doing the opposite. We're doing a little bit of an experiment. Because I'm thinking I might need to write a book or something. So we're going to take for the next 4 or 5 years. What we're going to do is try and strip her of all tools, just lay her bare and see what happens. But I'm taking copious notes.
No, but she'll come up with her own tools. You have no control about that.
Oh, yes, I do.
She'll figure it out.
No.
Yes.
Thing I want to get to is not this thing about the kids. All right?
Yes.
Let's leave the kids behind for a second. Because just like you did when you went to a spa in Brazil. What was that like?
Yeah. Hi. Okay. First of all, Brazil, which you'll read, I hope, in my article.
They sent you down there, right?
Yeah, man.
What magazine was it?
They sent me down there.
Vogue?
Yeah.
And I can't read that magazine because whenever I open up one of those type of magazines, the perfume in there, there's always like perfume, and I'm highly allergic to perfume.
No, I don't think in Vogue. I don't think they have those things.
It is in Vogue, but go ahead.
Brazil is this, you know, emerging, growing, expanding economy. It's all great. It's like it's a sort of fascinating country, right? So, but I went way, way remote to a village in on the Bahian coast that was founded. The person who founded Brazil, the Portuguese guy, went to this place in 1500 to Porto Seguro, and he saw, they saw.
How many indigenous people did he have to kill to set up that spot?
I'm not quite sure about that, because what happens is they're looking for silver and gold. They thought they were going to China, but they ran into South America and saw Brazil, and then they saw the Brazil tree, and they got all this these red berries, kind of red nuts, and brought it back to Europe and made a red dye, which they gave to the middle class, sold to the middle class, and that's how Brazil came to be. Brazil is named after the tree.
Okay.
Dig it. And but it was jungle. Sloths. An octopus came up to my foot when I was in the sea, and I saw it right there down in the sand. Parrots, monkeys, and then this tiny little untouched fishing village.
And you were basically coming there so that Vogue readers can go and touch it.
Well, they can go to this hotel. Wilbert Doss, who was the creative director of Diesel. The reason why we all can wear jeans to work is because of Wilbert Doss.
I don't even know what any of what you just said means. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, the way you dress is because of this guy, because he was a creative director of Diesel, which is a jeans company, for 20 years. And the reason why jeans are acceptable sort of as, you know, to wear all the time as they are, and they're marketed so they're sold for, you know, then it was $90 and it went, now it's $300, $400 for a pair of jeans, is because of this guy.
I don't wear jeans.
You don't? You wear cords?
No, I wear carpenter pants.
You do?
Yeah, so I can hold my cell phone, and then when you know, I'm doing stuff around the house, I can put my hammer in there.
You don't do stuff around the house.
Yes, I do.
You do?
Sure.
Can you rewire a lamp?
Yes.
You can?
Of course.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I know that about you. That's right. You can drive a tractor and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, this is this. You know what? This is getting to my movie. This conversation is.
Let's hear it.
Okay, so I was conflicted between two movies this week, and I was gonna do an experiment and have you pick the discussion you'd like to have, or the audience, so you could like email in, and so I could say, "Do you want to talk about this or this?" And then that would be the movie that I
would have been the great thing to do on a Thursday, and we would have had. We would have put it on the blog, but we can't do that. So now you're going to have to...
Ding-a-ling. Okay. So, all right. Well, we'll do that another time, because I often get conflicted about this. But, and especially since there was... okay, I'm not going to go into the other movie.
Okay.
This week, I've been interested in this movie for many years, but have not watched it, because I have there was a resistance in me that was quite strong. But I finally said, screw it. I'm just going to watch it, because it's called No Impact Man.
Seen it.
No!
Yes, but it's worthwhile talking about. In fact,
I
may have interviewed the guy on the show.
Really?
I don't
know. Colin Beaven?
Oh, no. You know what? I've met him. That's what it was. I don't think I was doing the show when I met him, but I met him.
Well,
tell us about
it.
Why weren't you going to watch it? Well, first of all, tell us about the movie.
Well, it came... Okay, so No Impact Man is this guy, Colin Beaven, I think is how you pronounce his name, and his wife, Michelle, and their daughter, little two-year-old daughter, Isabella. And this guy is a writer, and he said in the beginning of the movie, I want my writing to have a positive influence on the world. On the world. Which I found... I was like, oh, okay. That's fine, fair enough, whatever. So I'm going to do this experiment. I'm going to write a book called No Impact Man, and I'm going to do a documentary.
Now, why are we cynical about that? You think that's just too grand a scheme?
Well, I don't know. I just feel like when I write, I don't think about how it impacts the entire world. But, no, listen, I'm taking you through
the steps. That's a little bit self-centered of you, but go ahead.
No, but it's not self-centered. I think it's self-centered that he feels that his writing can impact the world. I am not a perfect person, so here I go through my steps. So I was like, oh, I had this like weird resistance to that, just that. And then he said, I'm not going to impact the world. I'm not going to create garbage. I'm not going to use electricity. I'm not going to I'm going to eat only from the farmer's market, only local produce. We're not going to, what did they do? No travel. They only rode their bicycles. They didn't take trips. They didn't buy anything new. They could buy things from secondhand stores. They had compost worms in their house. They didn't have electricity for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have television. They didn't consume anything they didn't need to. And so they said they were going to live their life like that for a year. And they did. So this couple, she works for Business Week, or she did at the time of the movie, and he's a writer, and they live on Fifth Avenue in a little co-op downtown in the West Village. And so they do this project. And so in the beginning, I had these same feelings of like, oh, this is so grandiose, and he had so many sort of, it just seemed really...
Full of himself.
Full of himself. But here's the thing. The whole time that I'm thinking about watching this movie and then during watching the movie, I'm thinking, I make too much impact on the world. My family does. I throw out things constantly. I'm sure if I measured how much garbage I make, it's some atrocious amount. Then I went to Brazil and that the whole thing with the rainforest. And I mean, and then I watched this whole thing, Frozen Planet, and that you know, the poles are totally melting. It's absolutely happening very, very, very quickly. And so it's in my mind. And this guy is, like, going to do this experiment about no impact. And I was feeling kind of guilty. And like, why don't I ever do that? And I'm such a consumer. And, this is terrible. But then I was like, but what is one guy going to do? One family? And so there was this, I had all this conflict about it. Do you hear that?
Yes, I do. And
so then, and the question is, can you live your life not using so much, right? And we all can. And they did.
That's what I took from the movie, was that because I don't know that, frankly, individual actions can make a difference. That we, or I should say, individual actions in this regard can make a difference. The real thing is that we need to change. We need to have government policy. The implications of that government policy, though, at least many claim, and I think it's true, is that in many respects, we're going to have to downsize our lives. And so the best thing about that movie was not that it shows that it can be done and that there's actually a lot of benefits to it.
Well, right. And also, when your worldview flips, it's affects other people. Everything, we don't live in a society anymore. We don't live in farming communities. We don't live in towns that where we really understand that our actions affect other people, right? So, we're, especially in New York City, where we are in the movie, we think we're just living little in our little bubble by ourselves, and it doesn't matter. We think that we are in big denial that when we throw away something, it's gone. You know, where back in, however many hundreds of years ago, that wasn't the case, because you could see if you threw your garbage on the street and your neighbor had to deal with it or whatever. I mean, we just don't see a lot of it. So if your worldview changes by lowering your impact, it will affect other people, which will affect a bigger political structure. It will, you know. Because the children will learn it, and then it will get there. That's what I kind of took from it. That
beautiful. And this is on Netflix?
Yeah, it sure is.
All right. Well, I saw it a long time ago.
You know.
And then I met him.
But
it's Name Drop Friday.
Was he nice?
Yeah, he was a nice guy.
Yeah, I don't know. He seems nice. I liked his wife.
Yeah. I didn't meet his wife, but. She's nice.
Here's what another this hippie guy who he goes and joins this garden. The other thing is that he's constantly on the Today Show, Good Morning America, Colbert Report, and so it's all these like huge industry, big business corporations, he's needs in to do his project. Mm. You know, tell me how much electricity the Today Show studio uses.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, there is an irony there. So, but this guy said this guy that has a little tiny garden in the West Village that taught him how to garden, said, you know, it's always 50-50, which is really my worldview. It's really what I think. It's always 50-50. You can do 50 good, and then there's 50% bad.
Well, Isabel, let me just say you've done 100% good today. And it's always a pleasure to have you on.
Well, it's a big pleasure for me. But, you know, okay, so the next time I'll do the other one.
Okay, good.
Because it's an equally interesting – but what I hope is that when people watch it, then they can have a good discussion. Because even though I was by myself, in my head I was having a good discussion with myself.
I get the sense that happens a lot, Isabel. IsabelGillies.com. When's the book coming out?
The new book, the YA?
Yeah.
Fall 2013, I think.
Oh, my God. All right.
It was very hard. It's been very, it's hard, man, right? It's like being in a little, this is how I think of it, being in a little boat on the Atlantic by yourself.
There you go.
Very isolating.
Waves come. You've got no fishing rod. You've just got a little bit of water left. Hang
in
there.
You got to figure it out. What wind, which way is the wind coming?
All right. I'll talk to you soon. We get all
Wait, can you just say one thing to me? Is it really true that someone has said that menstruation is like birth?
There's legislation where they're talking about, I don't know if he is referring to basically that's where you're going to measure. Menstruation will be the measurement of conception. If you, they will start to count the clock. Oh, yeah.
That's the craziest thing I've ever, I'm 42, and that is the craziest thing in this department that I've ever heard.
It's going to get worse, Isabel. Got to jump because they're going to.
They're lunatics.
They are lunatics.
That's crazy.
All right, Isabel. Hang in there.
No impact, man. Okay.
Wait a second. You're not supposed to get mad, too. Aren't you like a year without anger?
Yeah, but I didn't get mad. That's not getting mad. That's not losing my temper.
Wow.
That's just feeling. That's feeling something.
All right.
You think that's getting mad?
I don't know.
Oh, no. That's nothing.
I don't know if I want to be around when that happens. All right, Isabel. See you later.
All right, Sam.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jeff Smith, Occupy Wall Street Media. All right, folks, I have been notified that, what did I say? Menuation? What did I say? Menstruation, and it's menstruation. Ah, menstruation. Menstruation? That time when the ladies should be taken away from the tribe and stoned is, I think, is what we refer to it in this day and age in America. On the phone, Jeff Smith, Occupy Wall Street Media. Jeff, I wanted to have you on today. Special, like a sort of special guest, not just because, you know, we're all still basking in Tuesday's resurgence of folks hitting the street, but I was watching your tweets last night, and you were at this thing Prop, and it sounded fascinating. Tell me what it is.
Well, it was a panel by this group. It's police, if I have the specifics on it. It's called the Police Reform Organizing Project. And what it was a panel basically of all ex-cops. There was only one current NYPD police officer. And it was moderated by a reporter named Graham Raymond, who works for the Village Voice, who's actually one of the more experts on NYPD and police around. I would definitely suggest you having him on the program in the future. But it was, you know, a gathering. Basically, they were talking about their own personal experiences in the force, and most of it centered around stop and frisk and a lot of the arrests in terms of the numbers that they have to put up. And it was really quite eye-opening. I don't know to the other people, but there was about 100-plus people there, mostly just citizens of the community. And for a lot of people, it was definitely, I think, eye-opening to hear some of these stories. They were quite incredible.
There was an active-duty police officer there? That's pretty stunning.
Well, actually, I wouldn't say he's active duty. He's actually currently under suspension. And, you know, the story that he told basically was that he did not consent to some of the quota numbers and some of the stop-and-frisk type activities and ended up, you know, sort of backing down on one of the charges that he had made on someone and went to his supervisor and said, you know, listen, I'm having trouble with my conscience about this and what we're doing with these kids. And he ended up being charged with perjury and is now on suspension, and they're basically looking to try and kick him out of the force. So
wow. And so what? Tell me some of the things that these guys said.
Well, there was one guy who talked about, and it was an African-American officer, as most of these cops were. There were a couple of white males that were former cops who are now academics. Either one is a teacher now in the Bronx in the same district where he used to be a cop, and another is a professor, a PhD, who does criminology and that sort of thing. But the one African-American cop told a story, two really interesting stories. One is that he was brought down from the Bronx, his home district, down into Central Park for a detail, specifically to kind of, you know, balance out some of the racial discrimination that had been going on. And so he walks up to some people clearly drinking champagne in the park, mostly, you know, white people, of course, and he begins writing summons, you know, for open containers, you know, public display of alcohol. And the people there were frankly incredulous. They couldn't even believe he was writing them tickets. They refused to show IDs. And finally, he arrested one person because they couldn't even believe they were doing this. And when he took the person in cuffs over to his supervisor looked at him and said, "What are you doing? Let that person go. We don't arrest people here." And he was never brought again back to Central Park. And then to contrast that story, he told about an instance when he was in the Bronx in his own neighborhood, and he saw some other police officers writing a ticket to a 75-year-old black man sitting on his stoop drinking a beer with a brown bag over it. And he walked up to him and he said, you know, "Hey, man, you know, you don't have to do this. You know, come on. If you really want to arrest people with open containers, just wait until Yankee Stadium gets out and you'll see thousands of them. And more importantly, you'll probably see many of them get into their cars." And, you know, he ended up getting disciplined for that. And it's not surprising to hear why these guys ended up eventually getting out of the force. But a lot of them did actually do their 20 years and retired and have their pensions. And so for them to speak out like this, in a lot of ways, it's similar to what, you know, Ray Lewis did in Philadelphia. And frankly, it's just really uncommon for ex-cops to speak out this frankly. I mean, when they talk about the blue wall of silence, it definitely is real. And so when, you know, you hear these people being so outspoken, and particularly it was the quotas that to a person, literally every single ex-cop all talked about the fact that no one says that there really are quotas, but there absolutely are. And if anyone says there aren't, they're a liar. And what that really means is that, you know, the cops are out there.
Quotas for what?
Quotas for arrests. I mean, behind stop and frisks and the crime stats, that they're forced to go out there and produce numbers. And so cops actually hit the streets knowing, I have to make arrests. And so they'll lock up kids on their way to school and then, you know, dump them out the back door on any pretense. They'll make arrests and change the charges if they have to, you know, if they can prove it or they think they're going to get it, then they'll write it up as a higher charge. If they, you know, end up not getting it, they'll end up, writing it off as a lesser charge or lost property instead of a robbery. I mean, all kinds of really sort of devious things, all in the name of just what seems like senseless numbers and stats. And so to hear these cops talk about the fact that what's really gone on here is it's just like a system out of control. And, you know, when you think about 700,000 arrests, and that's the number they claim, you know that there must be literally hundreds of thousands more even that they throw away the paperwork or they frisk guys and then don't even report it. And, you know,
their own stats are that 684,000 people were stop and frisked, were subjects of a stop and frisk. That is over 1,800 a day. And, you know, I've said this before. Anybody who works in Manhattan, lives in Manhattan, tell me how many times you've seen that happen. You know, zero. Zero. And so you know what's happening, where it's happening. It's happening in the Bronx. It's happening in the outer boroughs. And it's just stunning. It's just stunning to me.
It really is. And you also have to keep in mind that these guys are, you know, they are, we're in fact cops. You know, and a lot of them got into it thinking from a law enforcement perspective that, you know, stop and frisk had some good behind it. In fact, one of the guys there, the PhD, was one of the officers that was involved in actually developing stop and frisk behind the original case. It was the Daniels case back under Giuliani, and he wrote the kind of book that they used to train the officers for stop and frisk. And he said, you know, I thought it was a valuable tool. I thought it did some good, but I have no doubt that right now the way it is being implemented is 100% wrong and is abusive and, frankly, unconstitutional. And so, you know, I think what a lot of these cops were trying to get out is that until, you know, frankly, white people and people that are not being hassled by this actually step forward and, you know, admit that this is going on and raise protest to it, that it's just not going to stop. And because the communities that are being terrorized by this are, you know, nobody listens to them, you know. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where it's almost absurd, but really, for the black and brown people in this city, it really is almost like a form of terrorism to have the police go out looking specifically for who am I going to arrest and targeting these kids. And you just wonder how, you know, they end up with these, you know, perspectives about the police. And then you understand when you realize that from a, you know, a school age, they're being literally targeted and you know, hassled for no reason. It's really stunning.
Do you have any sense of this is out of the Urban Justice Center. Do you have any sense of what they're if this is an ongoing program and what's happening?
You mean the Police Reform Organizing Project?
Right.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that they're trying to do is to continue to get sort of testimonial from, you know, both ex-cops and people that have suffered this abuse to just sort of get it more out in the open. I mean, it's a difficult process, obviously, because the NYPD, from a PR perspective, is very difficult to attack. And so, you know, but the more and more, you know, these Trayvon Martin case certainly brought more attention to issues here in New York. And, you know, previously, remember, there's the Romarley Graham. And even this morning on Democracy Now!, there was sort of stunning audio and videotape of a NYPD that, you know, burst into an old man's home and killed him after he set off his medical alert.
Oh, right.
Necklace.
I heard about that.
You know, so, you know, it's definitely a systemic problem. And in New York, it definitely feels like it's almost a whole different level than anyone else goes through. And so, you know, when Occupy Wall Street people and ostensibly people that have never had to deal with any sort of police targeting get even a taste of that, you realize really systemically what other people in this same city go through. And
I'm glad you raised that, because I want to ask you a question. I noticed that you were retweeting a guy named, was it a guy, Sean Carey?
Yes, he's a man.
And do you know who he is?
Sure.
Okay. Just tell us what he tweeted and just what you know about him, because this, you know, one of the things I pulled was a piece by David Graeber in Naked Capitalism, nakedcapitalism.com, where he relays stories from women who, starting at one point in the protest, somewhere around mid-March, there seemed to be a systemic use of sexual assault against female protesters, in part as a way of trying to get nonviolent male protesters to become more violent and give the cops an excuse to quash them. And then I saw these retweets from the Sean Carey sort of talking rather cryptically about an incident that he was subjected to. Just tell us what you know about that. I know it's probably not much, but just tell me what you know.
Sure. Well, Sean, you know, has certainly been one of the more prominent activists in the movement, certainly leading up to May Day he was. And he tweeted about an incident basically at the end of the day on Tuesday around 9 p.m. or so. He was just kind of walking by himself towards the subway to go home after a long day and was scooped up by a bunch of plainclothes cops and, you know, sort of arrested without any real charge or provocation, and was taken to a secret location and interrogated for a while, and then eventually I think he was released. But it's a similar story that I've heard of other protesters back in November. On November 17th, on that big day of action, a similar thing happened, and it was reported in a story by Colin Moynihan in the New York Times. A girl named Kira he wrote about, and basically the same thing happened. They just came in an unmarked van and showed up in the morning and snatched her and, you know, took her somewhere in an unmarked room and questioned her for hours and hours. And, you know, it seems to be consistent with these scare tactics. I think it's really they have a hard time identifying who the leaders are, per se, but some people, just because they're present enough or at least vocal enough in certain situations, they target them. And I think it's just designed to try and get people to step back and not be so active in the movement. And what happened in November to Kira is that right now she sort of has taken some time off and she got a little scared.
And in fact, Sean said that he's doing the same thing.
Exactly. So, you know, these are very young people, and, you know, I'm not as young, and I'm not so sure I wouldn't be scared by the same thing. But, you know, it's definitely troubling that they're using these types of tactics. And so to hear that they would use, you know, sexual assault against women or something like that, that sounds certainly plausible and frankly, something similar that has happened that you heard about in Egypt, that they would target women and do that specifically to, you know, both enrage the men and to scare the women away from participating.
Jeff Smith from Occupy Wall Street Media, thanks for getting us up to speed on this prop and these other stories.
No problem. You got it, Sam. Thanks.
All right. Talk to you soon. All right, folks. Let's I guess this is going to be Freebie Friday, right? It'd be a little bit silly.
Wow, I just realized what time it is.
Unbelievable. Let's go to the IMs. I'm happy now. Sam, public school has become very brutal along with our culture. It's an institution like many other that houses kids so their parents can work because families can no longer afford one parent staying at home. As the culture gets more brutal, our children become more brutal. Kids who go to preschool too early, infancy and up to three, are damaged because they may not bond to their caretakers due to child-adult ratios. This is a generalization, as there are always exceptions. Please post pics of you as a fat kid. I was too, and now I'm a fat old lady with most of my adulthood being normal, within normal weight. I'll see what I can dig up. Lawyer Matthew, name drop Friday. Indeed. Did I have any experiences with... No. I don't think so. What, you about to remind me of somebody?
No.
This was a slow week for me, a name drop. I saw Pete Dominic at CNN. I did CNN the other morning.
I think you were going to talk a little bit about your appearance on that libertarian show, I guess.
Yeah, you know, what I'll do is I'll attach it. We'll put out a bonus thing of the show. And then we'll talk about it maybe Monday or something like that. We don't have time now.
Yeah. It's a good time to become a member so you get that bonus.
I will tell you, yes, a great time to become a member, folks, so you can get this bonus, free bonus show. Extra, listen to it anytime you want. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, this is a complete
episode. I don't think we've ever done this.
No, this is the first time, I think.
And also, for those of you in New York City, this might interest you. I will be hosting the WWRL morning show from 6 to 9 a.m. Monday. So when I'm exhausted on Monday, you'll know why. Todd Gitlin will be joining us Monday. He's just written a book, Occupy Nation, I think it is. And I ran into Todd Gitlin at CNN that day, too, so that was nice. I sort of confirmed our booking. But this will be the first time I'm back on WWRL since, well, I don't know. Is Hartman on RL? I don't know. It's been a couple of years. So that should be pretty exciting for me. Maybe not for you. Jay Tingle. Sam, please stop talking about how you were a fat kid. It's disgusting. Sagita. I'm sure it's been said Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys had died of cancer. I didn't know that.
I was just typing that to you. It just happened. It was just broken on Twitter.
Oh, gosh. I had no idea. I didn't even know that he had cancer. Did you know this?
Oh, yeah. I think back in, 2009. He couldn't be at they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last month, I think,
there?
And he couldn't be there, so they didn't even get to perform.
Oh, gosh. Oh, that's sad. That's sad. Bush and Cheney's U.S. minimum wage would be $19 to $20 an hour if it had risen in line with productivity over the last 30 years. Yeah, I have that piece, actually. I didn't get to it. Thanks to Obama's economic stupidity, libertarian pea brains like Rick Santelli are having a field day on CNBC. Pat Robertson, America belongs to Jesus. Of course it does. Hey, Sam, do you want to do my I told you so Obama's job creation failure now or on Monday? Your choice. Do you want to do my I told you so? I don't follow. This is pure comedic gold. Enraged Ted Nugent threatens to F female CBS producer? What?
What?
Is there video for this? Oh, God, I got to see this. Wow. All right. So y'all know Ted Nugent, the Nuge. This is the guy who was talking in such a manner that the Secret Service was alerted and investigated him, who went on subsequently to say that Mitt Romney, who courted his support, Mitt Romney's people spoke to him after that incident and said, we stand behind you 100%. Don't shut your mouth. Now apparently has gone on CBS, and this is what he had to say, I guess. Well, this is an ad. So we'll get to it in 30 seconds.
All right.
These pre-roll ads, horrible, what they've done to
30 seconds too for something that's probably what, a minute long?
I don't know, maybe it's longer. The Nuge. He is the gift that keeps on giving.
Naturally.
Here it is. Here's the Nuge.
If Barack Obama becomes the president in November again, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year. Our president, attorney general, our vice president, Hillary Clinton, they're criminals.
Welcome back to CBS This Morning. That was rocker and activist Ted Nugent 3 weeks ago at an NRA convention in St. Louis. When his speech went viral,
Charlie
some
Rose
critics called it a threat against President Obama.
A few days later, Nugent got a visit from the Secret Service. In his first TV interview since then, he spoke with Jeff Glor about that meeting. Jeff, good morning.
Erica, good morning to you. Ted Nugent is loud, nonstop, never at a loss for words. He is also politically influential. Mitt Romney courted his endorsement and got it. And as we discovered...
Wait a second. I mean, seriously. Okay, I'm doing this story because I want to just see this guy say F you to a producer. But really? CBS News, with all their resources, is now using two of their hosts and one reporter to go on the politically influential Ted Nugent?
Firsthand during a visit to his Texas ranch, Nugent is ramping up the rhetoric again.
If Barack Obama becomes the president in November again, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year. We need to ride into that battlefield and chop their heads off in November. Am I, any questions?
Ted Nugent said that on Saturday, April 14th. Within days, he got a call from the Secret Service. When you heard from them, were you surprised?
In this environment, when you have the conditions in our government, no, I'm not surprised.
What did they say?
They said, hey, Ted, we have to meet with you. Somebody said you threatened somebody. I said, bring it.
Tell me about that.
I feel sorry for liberals who can be that brain dead as to take a clear statement of fear on my part and turn it into a threat against somebody else.
Nugent says the meeting took place at a hotel in Oklahoma where he was on tour. What did they say to you? How does that all take place?
Hey, Ted, it's good to meet you here. Thanks for giving us the time. And hey, we appreciate you responding to our request. And I said, and I appreciate it back that you guys are following up on your professional response.
There's something very wrong with this country. I don't know. We'll have to get to it. I can't. This is a 9-minute video. I'm not going to spend
9 minutes.
Yeah.
Who talks to Ted Nugent for 9 minutes?
Nugent's obviously suffering from meth addiction, dry mouth, loss of teeth, nice dentures. Nuge can't stop scratching his face, profuse sweating, and bouts of rage. Good news for Mark Maron, new mouth spray gets you drunk instantly. Oops, more bad news for Obama bot, criminal banking cabal-loving Keynesians. Dallas Fed proposes ending too big to fail, urges removal of failed CEOs, break up banks. Camp Geithner, neo-Nazi party that wants to work camps for immigrants, is on course to win its first seats in Parliament on Sunday. Obama's favorite too-big-to-fail banking cabal, Goldman Sachs, has done wonders for Greece since Blankenfein's doing God's work. Yahweh must be a fascist. More bad news for Democratic hero, Mexican drug launderer, private prison investor, White House tapeworm, Warren Buffett, Bank of America facing $6.2 billion collateral call. Oops. Guy from Silent Hill. Hey, Sam, long time no IM. Was wondering if you could get Atreos on. He just celebrated Eschaton's 10th anniversary of blogging, and I know he's been a frequent guest in the past. Yeah, you know, we haven't had Atreos on since like the first week of the show. I mean, I've tried a couple of times, but he's always had scheduling conflicts. But yeah, we'll get him on soon. 2-year-old's nose kid, snot nose kid. That was like a guy tolerating a conversation, waiting for the Jaeger to kick in for her, so she'll go home with you. I don't know what that meant. Cool J 146. I was checking out the Twitter of Dicey Troop, who was live tweeting the thing Jeff was at. He documented how one ex-cop speculated that the number of stop and frisks is over 1 million because many are not counted. I encourage you to check this out his hundreds of tweets from the meeting. Wow. Dicey Troop. I will do so. Spencer, I am a founding member of Chicago's Cop Watch and can testify that every single tactic your guest mentioned, the Chicago Police Department practicing, the Chicago police are using as well, especially the double standard applied to those living in communities of color. Thunderball. Gene Ling, hey, Sam, have you heard of the police program called DRE in Minnesota where the cops pick up kids and get them high for evaluation? What? Check the Tim Pool Facebook page for video. Tim Johnson, it's 88 degrees at midnight here in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. It was 99 degrees at 4 p.m. It's like a steam bath. So the big news is that a major environmental activist, Chuck Woody, whose tireless efforts to defend the last remaining forest of rosewood and teak from illegal logging led to his cold-blooded killing at the hands of military police. It's pretty rough here. The UN High Commissioner has demanded a judicial hearing, and international pressure may actually lead to a trial. Tim Johnson from Phnom Penh, thanks for the update. Kyle, you should cut the lawmakers some slack. It's menstruation, not womenstruation. Clearly an issue for men to decide on. Nice, Kyle. Greg, what would you say the arrest quotas are against individual liberty? I feel that there are some aspects of libertarianism which you agree with. Which are those? What would you say that... are against individual. Well, I am. I would say, as a civil libertarian, I'm probably somewhere around the 7 or 8 out of 10 scale. So, you know, I wouldn't call it necessarily there are aspects of libertarianism I agree with. There are aspects of which and where libertarians agree with me. but yes, I am closer to being a civil libertarian than not. What do you think can be done to fix the incentives? Well, get rid of the quotas. I don't know more about this project, this practice than, you know, we've just heard on the show. So I get to look into it a little bit. The final IM of not just the day. But the week, ladies and gentlemen, Sagita, let us know when you're going to be on TV. I will be on. You can hold your own with the most diverse point. Thank you. I will be on Radigan on Monday, but not before I am on this program on Monday. But before I am on this program on Monday, I will be on the WWRL morning show. Check it out at WWRL1600.com, I think it is, or 1600WRL.com. We'll put the link on the blog at majority.fm. Ladies and gentlemen, I bid you a fond farewell, and we'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend. The choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years while I shifted in and out of. Somehow